Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Grant Williams podcast. I am delighted that joining me today is an old friend and a returning guest of the show. And every time my guest joins me on the show, I get inundated with emails. Some of them saying, what the hell was he talking about? And the other saying, I really, really love what he was talking about. And they are heavily skewed to the latter. So I'm delighted to have him back. Dave Dredge of Convex Strategies in Singapore. We've had a couple of conversations on the podcast. As I said, plenty of people have been asking to have Dave back, and it's purely down to my travel schedule that he hasn't been on sooner. So what do you say? Why don't we get to it? And welcome Dave Dredge back to the podcast. David, welcome back to the podcast, my friend. It is so good to see you, and it's been way too long thanks to my ridiculous schedule, so thanks for bearing with me.
I do not know how you pop around the world the way you pop around the world. It's impressive. You're still a young man. I guess that's the key.
Well, you wouldn't know it to look at me after all that popping around the world. I'm aging by the hour. I'm like the reverse Benjamin Button, unfortunately, but my time will come. I tell you what, it is getting to me. It's not. But you've been on the road a bit yourself recently, right? You went bouncing around the States.
Yeah, popped over to the States, had a great time. Jim Grant invited me to speak at his 40th anniversary annual conference, and just a fantastic slate of speakers: David Einhorn, Paul Singer, Jeff Gundlach, Harley Bassman, Michael Hartnett. It was really, really a fun day. And as you might imagine, that the VIP speakers dinner afterwards was spectacularly interesting, that crowd. And then popped around a little bit. Julian came over, saw some people, and then we ended up down in Austin for the CBOE Risk Management Conference and did a little stint on stage there and got to catch up with a bunch of the VIX and S&P vol traders that I know well that are curious about the way I see the world and the weird stuff we do. And so it's great to see those guys. It was a really good conference and some really interesting stuff in terms of product innovation, stuff that the CBOE is working on. So it was good, other than the pain and suffering of traveling city to city to city.
Oof. Yeah, it's not fun. So what was the mood like in Austin?
It was really good. You know, I think the CBOE is a great crowd, and we had a great, like, a half-day session before the conference on product innovation, talking about their new dispersion index, and they're trying to launch VIX indexes on credit indices, so like a high-yield VIX and an investment-grade VIX. There's talk again of trying to pull together some sort of a futures contract on variance swaps. Now, I was impressed sitting around about, you know, I think of them as sort of the pointy end of the spear in terms of product sophistication, but there's still complication. It's still hard to work out settlements and margining and, you know, how the technicalities of how it all works, which I was glad to see, since, as you know, I spend my days doing that out here for bond markets in Indonesia and interest rates derivative markets in Korea and FX markets in China and all the complexities of trying to, you know, make the market function more efficiently, be more transparent, be more liquid. But it was a really interesting couple of days.
Fantastic. Well, listen, you've been prolific in your writing as always, and every piece you publish on the Convex Strategies website is kind of must read. And I get, every time you publish something, I get requests from people say, you need to get Dave Dredge back on the podcast. And I've been trying to do that, and it's entirely my fault that we haven't done this sooner. I hope everybody listening understands that you've been a very willing guest, and it's just been my schedule that's pushed us back. But, you know, that's funny, the longer we get pushed back, the more there is to talk about. So I think I take it as a positive. And I want to start your most recent piece, which I think you published in late October, The Hunger Games. And I wanted to start with that because you begin it with a quote, and this piece wrapped in so many of your recent pieces, including the presentation you gave at Jim Grant's conference about the Arrow of Time. So this quote you began it with, which I'm going to read now because I just thought it was fantastic. And this was from your April update last year, which just shows you how far ahead of the curve you were. And you wrote at the time, seriously, how did I expect it would end up? How did central bankers think years and years of ZERP, NERP, QE, TWIST, liquidity facilities, QQE, YCC, etc. would end? Did they honestly not expect it to inevitably come to a terminus with the system maximally fragile to higher interest rates? Were they not at least slightly suspicious that at exactly peak financialization, there might be a risk that the need to normalize policy would inevitably appear? One could surely argue that this very end state was so obviously inevitable that it was precisely their intention. If it doesn't work, do more. If it works, do more. That's it. That paragraph, that's the whole thing that's been going on. It's all the questions that need answering. So let's dig into that and begin to pick that apart and try and unravel that, because somewhere in there, I feel, is an answer of sorts to what the hell's going on.
Yeah, you know, it goes all the way back. Yeah, I say this every time we talk. We just keep talking about the same thing. It goes all the way back to our discussion 2 years ago about Afghanistan, about the sand pile and propping up of faux stability of the sand pile inevitably creates all the fingers of fragility, which are the inevitable economic speak, negative externality, unintended consequence down the road. And if you couldn't see that decades of zero interest rates and QE and zero risk-weighted assets and all of the premises that make fixed income, you know, this I always say in financial and the sharp world financial institution, fixed income sits on a spectrum from riskless to risk reducing. And if you get the entire system full on that at zero interest rates, as you know, we say over and over, as every country blows through 100% of debt to GDP, you have an obvious in-state problem where interest rates can't go up. And you and I have been talking about it for years. It's become now common speak in the advanced economic world, the phraseology of fiscal dominance and financial repression. Economist, what was his name? Calamaris, who wrote the note for that was published by the St. Louis Fed on fiscal dominance and financial repression. Now, amazingly, he was talking about that as a sort of forward-looking thing, seemingly unaware, or maybe he just didn't want to phrase it that way. It's been going on for, well, certainly since 2008, right?
In that paragraph I read, there's this quote I want to come back to. One could surely argue that this very end state was so obviously inevitable that it was precisely their intention. And this is the piece of this puzzle that I've been wrestling with for such a long time now, because it was so obvious what was going to happen. I mean, there was no other way this could go other than little magic green men coming down to the sky and fixing it for us. It was always going to be here. And so I've wrestled long and hard, and I don't know what either the right answer is or the better answer is whether they were ignorant or they knew this was going to happen, they did it anyway. And I just don't know the answer to that question. What's your best stab at that?
Well, you and I have ended up at that point in every conversation I think we've ever had. You know, this sort of magical parallel running of the science of economics and finance, random walk, Brownian motion, Gaussian, what I call sharp world, aligned with a desire for ever stronger, more influential government, the largesse of government, and a regulatory central bank regulatory construct of what really is just explicit financial repression, right? The whole premise, and we talked about it, you know, years and years ago, that it was explicitly decided to incent home ownership by giving mortgages preferential capital treatment on banks' balance sheets. It was explicitly decided to enhance the growth and living standard of periphery European countries by giving them the same risk-weighted asset treatment as German bonds. And then you're surprised down the road that there's not enough capital supporting the risk of these things on the, you know, what very clearly is the key systemic risk platform of the world, the banking system. You know, and here we are again, where, you know, I wrote about it at length last month, you know, where the lack of capital, the systemic risk in the system is obviously the regulated financial system, in particular banks and their holdings of government bonds in their financial repression, zero risk-weighted asset, hold to maturity, don't account for the losses, accumulate these massive unrealized losses. And I noted in the piece about Bank of America and their $130 billion of unrealized loss that if you factor that into their leverage ratio, their sort of gross leverage ratio, they're 50% of the regulatory minimum. And so I say this all the time, stock markets might go down as part of a correlated systemic shock, but stock markets aren't going to cause this systemic shock. You know, the systemic risk is the fact that there's no capital to absorb all of the duration losses in fixed income markets as interest rates have gone up. And I argue, and you know I do, and some of our friends get touchy on the subject, you know, that it was all part of a subconscious plan of this is the way we're going to grow. We're going to grow through credit, and then we're going to keep bringing demand forward. We're going to stimulate through fiscal largesse. We're going to accommodate credit creation through this financial repression concept. And then inevitably you get to the point where fiscal dominance takes over. Interest rates need to go up, and interest rates going up lead to greater fiscal deficits because everybody's fiscal circumstances through the magic threshold of 100%. And so higher interest rates could become inflationary because it means bigger government deficits to maintain the spending plus carry it. And I don't want to be mean to my central banking or policy planning or my former grad school econ professor turned treasury secretary, but
we don't have to be mean. We can be pragmatic about this because everything you've said is correct, right? They've seen this, they've made a very conscious choice. And implicit in that choice is the idea, okay, we do that and we get this, which is very desirable. But after that comes this, and that's not so desirable. Was there a deal of, mate, we'll figure that out when we get there, or it'll work itself out, or, you know, that's the bit that I just keep wrestling with. It frustrates the hell out of me because I kind of want to know what was said in those rooms and what was felt in those rooms, or if it was unspoken. But there feels like they must have known that one day we will run out of road with this. It's a great idea. It's going to create a lot of prosperity. It's going to create a lot of wealth. And I use that term in air quotes. We can probably have a good guess as to where that wealth's going to go, but it doesn't matter. It's wealth all the same. And you get the feeling someone said, well, let's discuss that next week. Let's just break for tea and scones now, and we'll come back to that next time, perhaps.
As you're well aware, we're not the first ones to ponder this question. Let me read a quote from my August Arrow of Time paper from Mr. Hayek, from his epic The Road to Serfdom book, you know, quite some time ago. Quote, "We are ready to accept almost any explanation of the present crisis of our civilization except one, that the present state of the world may be the result of genuine error on our own part, and that the pursuit of some of our most cherished ideals has apparently produced results utterly different from those which we expected." It's the central planning, to use Hayek's point. The ends justify the means, and the intentions excuse the ends. We were doing this because we expected, in a sort of simplistic mindset, a first order cause effect of stabilizing the economy, of reducing the impact of recessions, right? But we failed to understand, either through incompetence or through incentive or political justification, the second order effect, the third order effect of that, and the implications down the road, that sand pile becomes bigger and bigger. As we say every time we ever talk, if you keep preventing and putting out fires, the fire risk gets ever larger and harder to control. And the devastation of that, you know, punctuated equilibrium, to use physics speak on evolution, resets to something that functions in a power law dynamic that's very difficult for the tools used today, and you know that's my obsession, to measure, understand, predict, evaluate. And that ends up being sort of the driving force of how evolution, in biological speak, but how markets and economies and systems function.
So do you think that means that, to your point earlier about the systemic risk being the lack of capital that's supporting all this, do you think the idea there is potentially, well, capital is no problem. We've got an unlimited amount of capital. We can pull it out of thin air. We can change the rules. There are all kinds of things we can do to solve a capital problem because we don't actually have to solve it. We just have to convince the market that we're intent on solving it, and the market will play along. Do you think that's where we are? And do you think that the market will play along this time? Because it's worked previously when they've kind of shored up capital, but it feels a lot more systemic this time. It doesn't feel like it's a problem over here or a problem over there that we can come in and solve. It feels like everything's kind of in the same state at the moment.
Yeah, obviously we talked about it last year when we talked about my Is Sharp World Closing piece. If people decide to flee Sharp World because they don't want their money trapped in these negative real return, long duration, bad credits, then they're going to have to figure out a way to close the gates to keep people from leaving. Well, pretty sure we saw that in March earlier this year. Pretty sure we saw the implications of people withdrawing their deposits, withdrawing their confidence in institutions who, following the regulatory accounting requirements, were factually insolvent while being officially well capitalized. And then you take your money out and put it someplace that pays the market yield, and these guys go out of business. But exactly to our point, they can't let the money leave. So they close the gates. They say, as opposed to unwinding and resolving, as in bankruptcy speak for a bank in the US, as opposed to resolving Silicon Valley Bank, which would have been one of the easiest resolutions ever because the bad assets were US treasuries. They're easy to sell. They say, we don't want to sell the US treasuries. In fact, we don't want any bank to sell the US treasuries. So we're going to provide the BTFP repo facility where you can repo all of your non-mark-to-market treasuries that are worth 80 cents for 100 cents. And we'll replace the outflow of your deposits as long as your entire asset side becomes US treasuries. So this kind of gets to the title of my piece last month, Hunger Games. Janet's going to get hers, and those banks, and we see this. In fact, this is arguably what's driving what the markets are going through right now, this recognition, as we talked about last year, that they're going to have to keep going till they get to the recession. As I keep saying forever and ever, the good outcome is the recession, and everybody willingly buys these guys' bonds. And that's obviously what we've seen in November, the expectation of the recession. And one of the key indicators of that pending recession, I saw a great chart, I think it was Jim Bianco who showed it, of deposits keep going up, up, up through 2023, but starting in 2019, loans start flattening. And that's now accelerating because obviously those regional banks, they can fund US treasuries at 100 cents on the dollar, despite that being only worth 80, and replace outflowing deposit. But that doesn't leave them any capital and liquidity to go and make loans.
Right. But you talk about this under or uncapitalized tail, and you call it the 40. So just explain what the 40 is, because that gets to the root of this whole problem.
I use the 40 as just sort of my easy nomenclature to represent the misunderstanding in the traditional financial mathematics, which are embedded in the regulatory construct of financial industries, to represent the 40 and the 60-40 balanced portfolio. And the premise, I would argue the misspent premise, that the 40 is risk reducing, that there's riskless or risk reducing component of these bonds against this equity stuff. But when I say the 40, I mean the whole regulatory construct of zero risk weighted assets in banks and the concept that leveraging bonds in a liability driven investment scheme in a pension fund is risk reducing, not risk increasing. And so what's evolved from that, and again, this is why I say it's been financial repression since they invented BIS regulatory capital in the 90s, is financial institution, regulated financial institutions can own and lever government debt without treating it as risk. And so all of that risk that's gone on to these balance sheets, now the banks are the most obvious ones, at least in a pension fund, the loss flows through to the end capital owner, the pensioner. In a bank, the loss flows through only to the equity holders of the bank. The depositors don't take the loss. They're government guaranteed, and even the parts that aren't government guaranteed seem to never take a loss. But that lack of capital, and so the Bank of America example again, Bank of America has $220 billion of capital, not including the $130 billion of unrealized losses on their hold-to-maturity portfolio. So they only really have $90 billion of capital, supporting, the multi-trillion dollar balance sheet of other things. And I say all the time, banks don't go out of business taking risk. They go out of business levering the things that they're told aren't risky. Super senior tranches of subprime CDOs that you could tranche up and say a zero risk weighted asset. So it's the lack of capital supporting this deemed riskless stuff that even the slightest change in the valuation immediately impairs capital. And then, you know, Silicon Valley Bank or Credit Suisse, who's obviously that measure was across a much more complex swath of derivative counterparty, derivative transactions. But all of it comes back to the same problem. These things were all getting constructed and treated to slot into, as best as possible, the lowest possible risk-weighted asset. And you look at most of these banks, I think I did a scattergram of it earlier this year of, you know, what's their risk-weighted assets relative to their total assets. You know, the total assets are 2 to 3 times bigger than their risk-weighted assets. So, you know, you could simplify that down to is they've got, you know, 2x zero risk-weighted assets to what they have things that they're holding capital for. So it doesn't take too much change in the value of that for guys whose gross leverage ratio is only 6%. Now, of course, again, in the case of Bank of America, their actual gross leverage ratio is only 2.4%. So, you know, a 2.4% change on their existing portfolio of, you know, a couple of trillion dollars of total actual assets, isn't that big a change in a world where you may have noticed there's been some volatility in interest rate markets over the last few years and continues to be, right? And this is, you hear me say this all the time. You know, there's a reason that equity volatility, every time it spikes up, it comes straight back down again because there's not a lot of leverage, because the losses are incurred by the people whose capital's at risk. When interest rate volatility goes up, it seems like it stays up. In fact, it stayed up for a couple of years now, and it goes up, it comes down, it goes up again. And that's because there's so much sensitivity because of all the undercapitalization of that risk. And so whether that's the insurance company who was not marking to market the duration extension of callable note structures, or the pension fund who's loaded up on levered gilts, or all of these things mean that the hit to capital is much more severe and results in the panic. You know, what drives market panic isn't some sort of random change in realized volatility. It's a realization narrative that, holy shit, I don't have enough capital to support the risk I've taken in this because I use some stupid flawed model like value at risk, or some stupid accounting methodology like IAS 19 and European pension funds that said this wasn't risk. And now it turns out I realize it is risk, and it's so much risk. My pension fund's going out of business if the Bank of England doesn't step in and buy gilts, you know, weeks after starting to not buy gilts.
Let me ask you this. Through your lens, what happened back in March? Because when Silicon Valley Bank went under and Signature Bank and Credit Suisse and all this stuff happened, outside your world, we looked at that and it felt very 2008-y, right? It felt very similar. It felt like we'd been here before, and to see something like Credit Suisse go so quickly, and again, it was very 2008 in the way that it was quickly taken and wrapped into UBS and no one got a say in it, and this is the deal, it's done, it's over. And I think those of us who don't inhabit your world looked at it and went, uh-oh. And then everything got okay again. It kind of quietened down. They made this blanket statement about basically every dollar in every bank is insured, essentially. And particularly in the equity markets, people just went, nothing to see here, move on. But you can't help but get the impression that something materially changed. And whatever that change was, I have to think it's happening in the little corner of the room where you're sitting there like a Bond villain stroking your cat going, yeah, you have no idea what's going on. So talk me through what happened in March in your world.
I think Silicon Valley Bank was such a simple, and I wrote about it. In fact, it's maybe one of my all-time favorite pieces, my probability versus possibility piece that I wrote in March. And, you know, it just laid clear somebody did the homework and said, you know, they have $100 billion of hold-to-maturity, 8-year duration U.S. Treasuries that have lost 15% in the last year. So that's now a $15 billion loss, and they have $13 billion of capital against, you know, their tech company loans and stuff. And meanwhile, because it's a savvy bank, and people are saying, well, you know, they still want to pay 50 basis points for deposits against their 1.5% yielding U.S. treasuries when Fed funds rates are 5. And so savvy depositors are saying, I'm just going to transfer that money into this money market fund and make 5. It starts to come out and they need to sell assets, and they wisely call Goldman Sachs to raise capital and then sell the assets off their hold to maturity balance sheet. But of course, Goldman Sachs does it the other way around. It sells the assets first and then finds it hard to raise the capital. And you know, it opens people's eyes, and the Fed, the FDIC, the Fed, the Treasury, everybody immediately steps in. Now, remember, this is the same Fed, and I wrote about it in subsequent month, I think one called Credibility, you know, where the Fed did a review of it and said, oh, yeah, we missed the fact that they had become insolvent when they filed their year-end Basel reports 10 days earlier than going out of business. Don't want to criticize the supervisors in the San Francisco Fed who, you know, each cross-populated each other's boards. But then the BTFP, the repo, and the fact that everybody got bailed out again in Silicon Valley Bank, nobody was allowed to lose money other than the equity holders. At least this time the equity holders lost money. But as far as I know, everybody kept their bonuses from the year before when they accounted for this as a, you know, as a $15 billion wiping out all of the capital loss that didn't exist in their actual reports. And I noted in that one and subsequent notes that they all said we met our buffer capital levels, so we were allowed to pay bonuses and stuff. And then that BTFP just stopped it, right? And it, you know, the Fed just said we'll underwrite the entire outflow of deposits from the regional banking system into the six big globally systemic important banks, the G-SIBs. And it was fine. Life carried on, and except for the fact that inevitably that's everyone's holding on to Janet's bonds and not lending to anybody else. It's Hunger Games, right? Janet Yellen is the Katniss of bond issuance, and everyone else is going to get crowded out. And that's what's driving, in my opinion, driving us to the recession that they've been trying to get to all along, maybe not necessarily the way they thought they were going to get there. And then Credit Suisse, you know, through a series of bad decisions, bad business practices, bad regulations. I wrote about the Archegos and Viacom deal back when it happened in, I can't remember when that was now. But
2 years ago.
Yeah. And saying, because I had literally used that exactly as an example in some of my discussions with the local regulators here, advising them on things that they should be on the lookout for in terms of how risk gets reported to them versus what risk actually is. And, you know, saying that things like this equity swap, which you're measuring on the margin period at risk, should be looked at as put options. And if you looked at it as a put option, you'd say, well, we're not measuring that risk correctly. And the bank, who's, we talked about it before, is making a few basis points on the leverage, is taking all of the downside risk, and they don't measure it correctly because they're saying, well, based on this short look back period, the probability of Viacom going down more than 20% in 10 days is very small. And that goes down 80% in 2 days. So the recognition, the narrative, people pull their money out because they say, I can see this organization's not sustainable. The propping up support network of central banks and governments come in and violate everything that they've said about living wills and not bailing the banks out, do it all over again. The moral hazard is, you know, the Pavlovian response is everything's fine, carry on. And, you know, the liquidity provision and that I wrote earlier this year about the ECB talking, you know, after the Fed de facto, or the U.S. government de facto guaranteed all deposits. Not surprisingly, immediately thereafter, the ECB came out with a directive about re-enhancing their move towards a Euro EU-wide deposit insurance scheme. So let everybody know that we also aren't going to let deposits lose money in Europe. So don't move your money to those American banks. You know, closing the doors of Sharpe World. And so that recognition is out there now. The sensitivity is known, that there's just no capital in the banking system. But the belief is strong that, as you say, we know that they're insolvent, but as long as they don't have to account for the losses, you know, Bank of America, the CFO in their quarterly announcements, announcing $130 billion unrealized loss, says, but we don't expect to take any losses in the long run. We'll just hold these to maturity and we'll get paid back. And there's no concept that the negative accrual of funding these at market rates is an ongoing loss. There's no concept that the foregone opportunity set, I mean, what a great time to be a bank. what a great time to be an insurance company, a pension fund. It's the best yield environment, the highest growth environment we've seen in decades. And these guys are all sitting there on their hands with $1 trillion in 1% yielding hold to maturity bonds.
Right. But this is FASB 157 all over again, essentially, right? We're back there again.
And as you say, right, the world, the market, Mr. Market is happy with it. He's like, that's fine. As long as they don't have to account for it, as long as we know each individual institution will be propped up, then let's just carry on. And then if anything, I guess we come back to the externality problem. Well, therefore, have they done, will they do enough to squelch the genie out of the bottle in terms of price stability?
And this leads potentially to something else that you spoke about, which is, I think you called it the great stop loss, which is ultimately probably the big problem here. So talk a little bit about that, what it is as a problem and how we could potentially get there from here.
I guess we saw that in October, right? You saw the grinding higher of yields led by the Treasury, but everywhere, as you know, the Bank of America's, the holders of these things, you know, the pain starts to hit. I mean, I assume the CFO of Bank of America, having reported $130 billion loss in the third quarter, maybe had something to do with the continued bond market sell-off in October, because he's watching that 130 become 150 billion. And he's going to, you know, he's like saying, oh, geez, am I going to have to. And so there's a natural incentive, maybe not a forced imposed regulatory accounting incentive, but there's a natural incentive from somebody, shareholders, saying, hey, we want to be in the banking business, not in the holding negative carry treasury bonds business. So clean that up. And insurance companies in Taiwan and pension funds in Europe. We talked about this last time. I mean, we want to do something other than destroy the long-term wealth of our clients. And so that's the great stop-loss premise is if and when this carries on, the who's going to own the 40? Who's going to own all these bonds? Who's going to buy all these bonds? And who's going to outcompete Janet for that marginal scarcity of bond holding? And, you know, it's a grind. I say this all the time. People point out all the time, you know, look at November, look back at March. Man, when interest rates fall, they fall really fast. When they go up, it's a grind. My explanation for that is pretty simple. Most of the guys who are short bonds are on mark-to-market accounting. The guys that are long all the bonds don't mark them to market. It's hard to squeeze them out of their position. It takes a really long time for Bank of America to make the hard decision to start reducing that exposure. And you know, I don't mean to pick on Bank of America. They're just the one who announced the shitty stuff.
They were the foolish ones who actually told everybody what was going on. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
they could have been like Citibank and just refused to disclose it.
Yeah, well, it's funny, you know, because there's been a lot of talk about this idea that the Fed is trying to generate a recession. And I think most people, when they talk about that, what they're referring to is we want to soften the economy. We want to soften inflation. We want to get growth down a little bit. We want to take the heat out of the economy, take the froth out of the economy. But your point is probably more important, and I don't think enough people are thinking about it that way. It's we need buyers of bonds, and a recession is going to have them scuttling out from, you know, the corners of the room into the middle, climbing over each other to get bonds.
Yeah, which we've seen, of course. You know, we both know too many people who have been doom and gloom and bearish and calling for recession for 2 years, maybe longer. And, you know, now they're hitting the crescendo. Look at all these, you know, very detailed, get into the trees data points. But my argument is, you know, they want the recession. We talked about it a year ago that they will keep the yield curves as inverted as they possibly can to convince people the recession is nigh and keep people from selling off the back end. We saw finally, amazing, I listened to it yesterday. You know, we talked last year that the pain, the thing that would trigger the real pain was a bear steepener. September, October was the ultimate pain. And the whole narrative shifted. And as I wrote about, you know, the Janet Yellen came out and reduced her back end issuance. because of the pressure from the Treasury Borrowing Advisory Committee, which I wrote about, which is the only place other than my babbling, the Treasury Borrowing Advisory Committee, made up of the biggest dealers, buyers of treasuries, told Janet the same thing. We can't buy anymore. We're full. Stop it. Right. Now, funny, they never write that in their sell side research, but when they're trying to influence her issuance, they laid out the pictures of the great stop loss, right? There's the picture of how much banks are reducing their bond holdings quarter after quarter after quarter, as opposed to obviously haven't been, other than central banks, the biggest buyers, because zero risk-weighted assets, maximum leverage, hold to maturity, no accounting, accrual accounting, right? Riskless. I mean, literally, you know, from an accounting perspective, riskless. And you can pay yourself bonuses on the accrual interest against the financial repression of depositors sort of forced to accept zero on deposits. And now they've been reducing. And as we all know, the relative scale of foreign reserve managers has been declining on a relative basis. And so I think exactly what you said. I think the recession is the good outcome, because it gets people to buy the bonds. And if the bad outcome, if that good outcome includes declining other asset markets, equity markets, well, that's a loss into the end capital owner that's acceptable. If it's a loss, a recognition of forced, the great stop loss, a forced recognition of the losses in fixed income, well, it wipes out the banking system. It destroys pension funds, insurance, you know, that's systemic. That's what the systemic risk is there.
So yeah, it's funny listening to that and reading your work, you can't help but feel like the recession is the soft landing, which is such a crazy concept, but it feels like that's the reality, that we could get a soft landing and a recession. And the answer to both is yes. Right? Yes, we did get a soft landing. It was a recession.
End of October, early November. Have you ever seen and heard such enthusiasm for a shift in narrative around things really are slowing down?
Yes!
Yeah. Finally.
The confetti.
Finally.
Right? And you have the best month, one of the best months in all of history for stocks and bonds. Right. Having gone through 2 years, as you know, I wrote in December 2020, inflation is upon us, 60-40 is dead. And after that turned out to be true until November, and it's the best 60-40, you know, month, you know, recoup. Well, you say it's the best 60-40 month. All it did was recoup the losses from the three previous months. But still, in a very concentrated period of time, you have massively out of proportion moves in NASDAQ, S&P, MSCI World, U.S. Treasuries, JGBs. And right now, a few people asking the question that I posed last month, is the loosening in financial conditions possibly preempting the recession that we all desire so much? It's a funny, and I mentioned it the other day, you know, in October, all of the Fed mouthpieces were out saying that the sell-off of bonds was doing the tightening for them, so they wouldn't have to do as much tightening. In November, the complete reversal and more of that, nobody comments on. Nobody says, well, that's doing more loosening than we intended.
No one's talking about the massive loosening of financial conditions that's happened in the last month or so. Nothing. It's like omerta.
Such good news. I mean, I think I dubbed it, maybe it was on a different podcast last year, the immaculate recession.
Right. Yes, that was not me. I like that. I would have stolen that if I'd heard you use that. Okay, so listen, you teased us at the beginning with your presentation at Jim's conference, The Arrow of Time, and that kind of preceded The Hunger Games. So talk a little bit about the premise of that presentation, and let's get into that, because it's, and again, people can read the piece on the website you wrote back in, I think, August, was it? I think you published this.
Yeah, that was the August one.
Give us the premise and let's dig into it, because it's more fascinating stuff to think about.
I dubbed that and then gave my presentation at Jim's thing, Compounding Imbalances in the Arrow of Time. And sort of the first half of the presentation kind of goes back to my June piece on the one thing, sort of the importance of time to the compounding path of an investment portfolio. We can come back to that later. And then sort of the second half is the time element of these imbalances, these unintended consequences of propping up the sand pile. And I've been writing for a long time. I think we talked about it last year. I first put it in, I think, my July 2022 note, this fantastic scattergram of the long-term history of CPI in the UK. And sort of a guy named Ricardo Race, who's a well-known economist in the UK, put this in a paper that he did in the summer of 22. And, you know, this goes back to 1200 and something, God bless the Bank of England. And it's just a simple dot, 20-year periods of the CPI measure. I don't know how he's reconstructed it going back that far. The x-axis is the average CPI over that 20-year block of the monthly CPI. And the vertical axis is the standard deviation, volatility. And the anomaly of all these dots across this grid is this one dot right in the center, 2% average, and almost to zero in the volatility measure, where everything else is above 5. And that's the 20 years, 1997 to 2016. Now, this is the ultimate, in my opinion. This was this whole game of creating this path to the fiscal dominance and financial repression. A big part of that was the decision to target this price stability measure. You know, I'm always reluctant to call it inflation. It's a measure of a very narrow slice of prices. And they held it there. And on the back of that, credit grew and grew and grew. And that created the Alan Greenspan, I blame, central bank reaction function for the negative correlation between bonds and equities that created the modern portfolio theory key correlation of a balanced portfolio, which grew into risk parity and all the different versions of this reliance on historical volatility and correlation. And what inevitably happened, what did they expect to happen? Eventually, that application of leverage and ever-growing fiscal debt and zero interest rates and massive leverage in the financial system, which, you know, exploded after Glass-Steagall went away and everybody moved on to BIS regulatory guidelines and could gross up their balance sheets using this RWA methodology. And then since 2020, that average and volatility have exploded. That number's moved up and to the right, and that has triggered this change in the system volatility, nominal GDP. Lots of people, it's not just me, talking about how volatile nominal GDP is. We saw whatever it was, 8-point-something% in the third quarter as we enter a recession, and volatility of interest rates. So it's and to me, this is sort of the challenge. And you can see that imbalance in this, you know, sharp world financial regulatory construct and the pressure it's putting on the system, because everyone was told that would go on forever, that we would have exceptionally low volatility of price stability and central banks that could always underwrite and inflate asset prices without any trade-off to this price stability measure. And once that genie got out of the bottle, now we're told, and this is really, to me, the argument of the argument, right? Are they putting the genie back in the bottle? Or are we going to have, as we have had, super volatile measures of that price stability up and back down again? And are we going to go into an accentuated boom-bust cycle? And so you can see and this is sort of the premise of, you know, then my presentation at Jim's. Jim didn't want me to just talk about science the whole time. So he insisted I talk a little bit about economies and markets and stuff. So, yeah, you've got this sort of global wide fragility imbalance that has developed through time, the arrow of time. Time is the one thing in physics that's asymmetric. It only goes one direction. The rest of space has, you know, action and reaction, but time is asymmetric. That's the arrow of time from Sir Arthur Eddington, if your readers want to go and Google it. Kind of the transition from relativity to quantum mechanics was the addition of time and the complexity. And so you've got that big fragility in this battle of trying to restore the narrative, using Ben's words, of, oh no, we got everything under control. Clearly we don't have everything. You know, the genie's out of the bottle. We don't have everything under control. And to get it back in control is causing, you know, volatility the other direction again. And that's in the banking system, pension system, insurance system, wealth management system, anybody that's been practicing modern portfolio theory and efficient market hypothesis is now sort of scratching their heads. Can we rely on and believe in those past periods of low volatility and, I would argue more importantly, stable correlation? And the application of all of this leverage in the financial system to the belief in that created an environment of correlation that everybody depended upon. Now, the bursting of that keeps pricking apart. And I saw something you were talking about. I guess you were in Switzerland at some commodities event and did a little recording, sort of pulling apart of what we thought were normal correlations. And you were talking about gold. And shouldn't gold, as real interest rates got higher and higher, have gone down? But it didn't go down. And so these stable correlations that people have come to believe in and construct massive levered risk parity type portfolios around, getting picked apart little by little. Now, that's all driven by the negative correlation between bonds and equities. And so that was sort of the big premise. That's the fire danger, if you will. That's where the most dangerous brush and stuff, and that's what they're trying to protect. That's why inverted yield curves are better than letting inflation run and blowing up back ends of yield curves. And then you've got the potential triggers, the hot spots in that. And you know, my favorite whipping boy is Japan and then China. And so interestingly, you know, when I spoke at Jim's and I went on from, you know, sort of the big picture of the global sharp world lack of capital against fixed income holdings, and then talked about Japan's role in that and the implications of Japan switching from being a provider of liquidity to being a competitor in the Hunger Games, having to fund from the available liquidity in the market their 260% of debt to GDP. Lots of people misunderstand when I refer to, you know, JGB as the most dangerous peg in the world. I'm not necessarily talking about the danger to Japan, but the danger to the world. And then the fragility that is probably more apparent to people of China after China's role of credit creation post-GFC, virtually the singular provider of credit impulse to the globe for a decade. And now the implications of that and how they're dealing with that. And again, their challenges in this Hunger Games competition where they are desperate to roll over their debt. And interestingly, you know, as you're probably more aware than I am, because I don't get there very often. There's a certain myopic US-centric focus in the United States when you're there. I was surprised how many people seemed unaware of the implications of Japan and China. I mean, granted, only the second, third largest economies in the world and US's key trading and ally frenemy dynamics, they were like surprised to hear that there were such countries.
As keen as I am to go down the Japan rabbit hole, and I will, because I've been fascinated by it for some time now, and I really want to talk to you about it. But I just want to stick to that scatter graph that you mentioned about CPI, and I'll put that in the transcript of this because people should see it. But when I looked at that scatter graph, what was fascinating to me, as you say, that period is right at the bottom of the volatility axis and right in the middle at 2%. But when you look at the rest of that chart, you realize two things. One, the speed with which it moved up and to the right in the next period, and then again to the most current period, is remarkable. But also, going back, 800 years, you've either had extreme volatility or much higher inflation. They're the clusters. There's a cluster of very volatile, and there's a cluster out to the right. It's not as big a cluster, but there's a cluster out to the right of much higher inflation. There's not so much in the kind of low volatility, reasonably calm, benign inflation area. And so, you know, again, we come back to this idea that everything in Sharpe world that we believe to be true is true, but only in the little bubble that we're living in. As soon as you put one foot outside it, you realize the world is very, very different indeed and is likely going forward, because I believe that we are outside that now. We have stepped outside of the bubble. It's a very, very different world. And yet, markets and many investors are behaving as though we're going back inside the bubble again and it's all going to be fine and we'll get through this. And Silicon Valley Bank, we've got that under control. And the bond mark-to-market losses, they're under control now. So everybody back on the bus and away we go. That seems like very dangerous thinking to me.
Yeah, and I think it comes down, I talk about this a lot. This is back to the way the good outcome is a recession. And then the traditional central bank response to that, we're going to cut rates back down again. And that just reaffirms that we're still in the same cycle, right? It's just cycles. It's just cycles, and we grow, we get too hot, they hike, we get a turn, they cut, and you know, we just keep going in this cycle versus the potential scenario, the we'll call it Neil Howe fourth turning, that this time it breaks free. We break free from the gravitational pull and go spinning off into space. And again, back to that chart of inflation, you can see most of history was spinning off in space. Now, interestingly, as you noted, you're spinning off in space in terms of volatility, but the actual inflation is still lumped around between 0 and 2. So in a way, the higher volatility on average means you have less divergence. The low volatility results in greater divergence. And again, sandpile theory, right? If you know, the other sort of anomalous low volatility, low inflation is the block 1877 to 1896. Well, the subsequent years after that were complicated. There was almost wars everywhere. And you know, is it better to suppress the volatility? Is it better to put out every fire, or is it better to allow natural occurring order of fires that clean out the dry brush and et cetera, and actually becomes more robust? The system becomes more resilient, more. Well, that chart will tell you high volatility of price stability measures in some ways is more robust than suppressed volatility. And like you say, there's this sort of clustering out in the high inflation average of, you know, specific time periods, the 70s and the late 30s, and you know, again, following periods of suppression. And you know, and this is my whole argument from a business perspective. My whole premise of life is that you don't optimize to the mean of the expected outcome. You optimize to the divergences from the mean of the expected outcome. The mean is never realized. The mean's just the average of the divergences. And so if you're optimizing to the mean, your divergence from the mean is deleterious to your outcomes. If you're optimizing to the variance, then divergences from the mean are beneficial. Well, if we're going to go into a world where the volatility of this core stability measure, which then feeds through to volatility of interest rates and asset prices and nominal GDP, do you want to be optimizing to the expected mean? I don't think so.
No, we've done it twice now. We've talked about Japan and now we've talked about suppression and stability. So we have to follow that up and talk about Japan, because I think the point you made there is the important one. And that is this idea that people are thinking about it the wrong way around in terms of what it means. It's not a problem for Japan. It's a problem for the rest of the world. And I've been looking at this a lot this year. And it's funny, you know, I sit down to write every month and I sit down and think, okay, what's interesting this month? What is interesting me this month? And I'll write about it. I don't have a plan until the week I write, because I find if I do that, if I try and write early, something else happens and I go, oh, you know what? I need to write about that. And 3 times in the last year, I've sat down and it's been Japan. And I haven't written about Japan 3 times in a year for a long, long time. And so something is happening. And the most recent time I looked at it was exactly what you said. You know, this idea that they are on a path to normalization is an incredible shift for so many things and so many countries and capital flows. And yet, you know, I talked about it being bullet time, like the Matrix, that you've got this massive thing that's happened, but everyone miraculously actually has time to position themselves, because you've got time to duck the bullets and bend over backwards and pick this stuff and do stuff, because people aren't reacting to it just yet. And
oh, I'm so stealing that.
Oh no, mate, it's all yours, have it. But I'm so fascinated by this, because as you said, you know, the second biggest economy in the world, or was now third, but it's still a meaningful economy, who are doing something that is ripping out what has underpinned the entire flows of capital markets for 20 years, and no one seems to care. I'm fascinated at your take on that.
I'm obsessed with it. I think it's the most fascinating and most dichotomous thing in the world, right? Because it's so different to everybody else, where everyone focuses on, and you're right too, the 260% of debt to GDP and a central bank that owns, you know, north of 50% of the entire government bond market. But it's got a couple of things that are very different to what we were talking about the rest of the world. Where did the central bank take all those bonds from? They took it from the banks. You've had almost a complete shift of banks that in Japan, because of the lack of borrowing demand post their bubble burst in the late 80s, their balance sheet filled up with bonds, financial repression, to fund the government spending going all the way to 260% of debt to GDP to try to mitigate the recession cleansing that otherwise would have taken place quickly to try to drag it slowly. But now here we are at this point, and all the stuff that we've been talking about all along this conversation, Japan's banks don't own a whole bunch of JGBs. They're not fragile from the same perspective of the hold to maturity US treasuries and European government bonds that European and US banks are. Likewise, the private sector, households and corporates in Japan, are not loaded up on debt. They've been deleveraging, thus the lack of growth for so long, for decades. And so the recessionary implications of higher funding costs for massively indebted households and corporates isn't the same problem in Japan. So the analogy that I always come back to, you know, Japan reminds me of the US post-World War II, post-Depression. So through the Great Depression, I mean, what was the Great Depression? It was basically a cleansing of all private sector debt. And then you had the war, which was another 5 years of austerity where only the government borrowed and spent. And then you came out of it and the government crowded in private sector borrowing. And you had sort of the longest growth in investment, private sector investment, which proved to sort of build the infrastructure for the future of the US. I can't get out of my mind that Japan has an opportunity to crowd in the private sector, that a very simple get out of the way Bank of Japan, reduce government, and start crowding in the private sector. I mean, the opportunities to do business grow. I mean, that, you know, everybody knows the stories about how efficient profit margins in Japan, because the only way you could make money, there's been no financialization in Japan of buyouts and leveraging and all this, you know, share buybacks. And it's just profit margin. It's just cost efficiency. It's productivity gain. You've got all these uber efficient companies and no debt, and a potential window in the world where the whole world is hurt by higher interest rates and private sector, corporate household Japan is not, in a sense. But you need the government to get out of the way and the Bank of Japan to stop mucking it.
It's not just that, because the Bank of Japan can not only get out of the way, but because of the culture in Japan, a quiet word from the Bank of Japan saying, hey guys, we think it'd be a great idea if you brought a lot of capital home. That's all it's going to take, right? And you will see hundreds of billions of dollars getting swapped out and brought back. And so I sit and I look at what the yen's doing, and it makes no sense to me. It makes no sense at all to me what's happening. And I look at the real lack of interest, except among people that spend their life watching Japan, for a proper first world economy, as you say, with lean, efficient companies, world-class technology. You know, it's got everything going for it, except it's kind of the flip side of this bubble we've been in for 20 years where everything's great over here, Japan's terrible over there. And even though people have stepped one foot out the bubble, instead of looking across the way and going, hey, there's another bubble we could actually go and step in here where it's going to be great for maybe 10, 15 years, they're desperate to get back to that comfortable environment where Japan's terrible and we fix all the problems over here and everything's going to be fine. And I'm baffled by it. I really am, because it's not like the passage you read at the beginning there of yours. What do you think's going to happen? You know, how do you think this is going to play out ultimately?
I ask Bank of Japan every quarter, what if it works? What if you actually get inflation? We don't think it'll work. We're sure it won't work, you know, as it just keeps working. Yeah, I think Japan's fascinating. I think it is the most interesting. And I think in the Hunger Games dynamic, I think it's the key player, because it's the only guy printing $1 trillion a year of fresh liquidity, which, you know, you don't have to be a trained physicist to see which way that liquidity flows. It goes out, right? Because dollar yield just keeps going up, right? And inevitably. Now, you reverse all that. Who's the winner? Who's the loser, right? You take that liquidity back out of the Hunger Games arena and say, we're going to keep it at home, or we're going to bring it back home. Still the by far the largest net foreign creditors in the world. You know, the largest foreign owner of every major bond market in the world, of every, you know, French government bonds and U.S. government bonds and CLOs. And so them providing this liquidity, and I suspect at G20 meetings and IMF meetings and World Bank meetings, people say, maybe in the old days would have been accused of being currency manipulation. They say, now carry on. It's okay. Keep going. Let's keep going. We don't mind so much now. We don't mind so much right now. So I think Japan's fascinating. Obviously, from a business perspective, we're up to our eyeballs in Japan because we're looking for markets that are liquid, where people are yield seeking by embedding, you know, structural derivative products and stuff to create enhanced yields. Well, where is that? For 30 years, that has been Japan, spread to the rest of the world, and now has come back to being Japan. And it's fascinating. You know, obviously, Ueda-san has continued the staging out of YCC, and what he did in the October meeting, you know, effectively ends YCC. YCC is no longer a line in the sand. It's a discretionary. We'll come and buy bonds if we think yields are too high, and we'll do it as much as we have to do it. We'll continue with our traditional QE, but there's no longer a line in the sand that, as you know, everybody knows, a line in the sand is just a red flag to a bull, right? It's just, well, let's go and challenge it and see what happens. And I think it's people aren't paying attention to Japan. They're missing what I think is probably the key pivot point for the whole globe right now.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the vol space and what you're seeing there. Because, you know, and again, I would encourage anybody listening to this that hasn't listened to our previous conversations to go back and listen to them. Because when you talk about your race car analogy, I've had so many emails about that over the years. And it's such a great way of thinking about vol. So I'm going to get you to do it again if I can, because there will be people that haven't listened to it. And I know after doing this, they'll want to go back and listen to it again. But just give us a quick recap of that analogy and then talk to us about what you're seeing from that perspective. Because this idea of being completely agnostic to everything but price when it comes to volatility is so different from the way 99% of the people listening to this think about the world. So I think it's just really useful to have that perspective of yours refreshed.
Can I steal from your friend Peter Atwater as I talk about this?
Peter will be honored, I promise you.
I talked about it in my last note because I listened to your fantastic interview with Peter talking about his new book, The Confidence Map. And this is exactly what we do, what we talk about, right? And so Peter's confidence map is a grid of low to high certainty versus low to high control. That's the whole point of everything, right? Everything that is path dependent, where you have skin in the game. You want control during times of low certainty and high certainty, because that control, and to our analogy, who wins the multi-lap Formula One race? The guy who wins, the guy with the best brakes, because he's most likely to finish because he's got the best brakes and he could drive the fastest. And so those brakes are exactly, to Peter's grid, control. The brakes give you control. And so when a curve pops up that you weren't expecting, or it's tighter than you expected, you've got brakes. And so you're in the high control, low certainty environment. And when you're in a straightaway that looks absolutely delicious, you can put it down because you're confident that if you need it, you got the brakes. So the whole point of convexity, so convexity in essence is control, is confidence in an investment portfolio, so that you can drive faster. That's the whole point. It isn't to be bearish. It isn't to reduce risk. I mean, we talk about it all the time. The biggest flaw in the investment risk management in the world of investments is everyone thinks risk management is reducing participating risk. 60-40 Kelly criterion is deleverage, so you probably don't crash. So just drive slower. And because so much of everybody's wealth, of the system's wealth, is managed by the fiduciary system, pension funds, wealth managers, sovereign wealth funds, insurance company, banks, there's no skin in the game. The guy's not in the car. He's driving remotely while you're sitting in the passenger seat, to Peter's example. So you have no control. And he doesn't really care about brakes because he's not in the car. And he thinks, the fiduciary thinks, that all the cars stall over equal at the next lap because his compensation, his incentive, resets to zero. But the capital owner, what he cares about is separation. He's trying to target terminal outcomes 40 laps, 40 years from now. What he cares about is the compounding path. And he's cognizant, and in life, and this is goes back to my June note, the one thing. Yeah, I quote Curly from City Slickers, what's the one thing? And we all know the one thing in a car race is brakes, right? The one thing in our compounding path is solvency, right? If we lose all our money, we can't dig our way back out of it. And where we have skin in the game, where people have skin in the game, and this is our ongoing project, is trying to quantify all of this, but people with skin in the game innately understand that it's the time average that matters, because our path is our path. Our risk is our risk, right? It's not a single slice of time with 200 parallel universes calculating an ensemble average saying, well, it's very unlikely that I get a one percentile outcome. But in my individual path through 40 years, I will get all of my one percentile outcomes, right? And those will be the drivers of my compounding path. So I want to always have brakes on my car so that I can always drive with confidence. And I don't want to try to time or guess or predict. And so when we get Peter and we do a three-way one, I'm going to get him to adapt a little bit. And you know, right, this is what you see day in and day out in your world. Everybody's trying to improve the certainty through prediction, not improve the control. The solution is improve the control and benefit when the expected outcome, when you diverge from it, back to what we were talking about just minutes ago, it's the divergence from the mean that will drive the outcomes. And in the construct of modern portfolios, everything's optimized to the mean. And so the divergences, which are the drivers of the compounding path, are a disbenefit. If you optimize to the divergences, those divergences become a benefit. And it creates, and all the pictures I stick in every month and all my charts, the blue line is the convex race car driver with good brakes, and the red line is some traditional risk parity, 60-40, hedge fund, whatever proxy. And there's this separation that just goes through time. And you can see that the separation expands in periods of volatility, both down and up, because you can drive faster at the best part and you're more efficient. And, in any true race car analogy, the opportunities are in the tightest turns. That's where the biggest opportunities are. And if you can turn those tight turns into a benefit instead of a disbenefit, well, then you're the guy accelerating out the other side while the other guy's hanging on for dear life, hoping that his two standard deviation probabilistic estimate of what average lap speed should be is going to hold up. How's that?
That's perfect. But how has that changed in this last 18 months where the environment has changed significantly? That description of what you do and how you do it and why, and more importantly, why it's important has always been so compelling to me. But I know that there are periods where people don't want to hear it because of the environment. Has that changed? Because I would imagine it would have to in the last 18 months.
When we talked a year ago, I said, going into last year's pivot, fourth quarter pivot, it seems to be a tradition now, there was a fairly strong recognition that the key correlation component of bonds to equities had sort of broken down, and that losing control, the genie out of the bottle of this price stability suppression, had created this problem. Now, we talked about it then. Of course, at that point, as everyone, again, this was, I think it was November of last year when we talked, that we were in yet another pivot. Everybody was saying, well, but now at these yields, bonds will be a good investment. And then, of course, through October, that was a disaster again, right? Bonds were not a good investment. And equities were a shockingly good investment. And now with November, equities are having an epic year. So, the car that had good brakes and is able to take advantage of the epic good year in equities. It's a pretty good year this year, baby. This is a good year. I can't tell you how many conversations I have right now with people saying, well, we're up low single digits this year, but given how complicated the market is, that's pretty good. Well, fuck, NASDAQ's up 40. What are you doing? Well, we took such a hit in our 60-40 risk parity construct last year that we came into this year massively overweight bonds because the yields were good and we thought that would be safe, and massively underweight equities. Oh, how'd that work? Not very good. So again, they're constantly deteriorating as you diverge from expectations. Now, I can't wait to see, you know, how everybody wants to talk after November, an epically good month for 60-40. Again, only recovering the losses from the previous 3 months, but there's pretty strong rhetoric out there right now that the previous 2 years were the anomaly. And back to our Bank of England CPI data, the 800 years before that, we're not going to pay any attention to. But this 20 years in the middle, that's the real thing. It's a constant fight for us, as you know. Now, touch wood, we've got some really fantastic partners and investors that have been with us and stay with us and have benefited from the compounding opportunities in the last decade of having more risk and cutting off downside. Been pretty damn good. Really, really good. And the separation between those compounding paths of something that was convex versus something that was not is shocking. And yet, to the guy who still wants to optimize one lap at a time, as opposed to optimizing to the termination of 40 laps, he says, that's just not the way we look at it, Dave. We look at the mean. We look at the mean of the expectation. And our expectation is that, and all of our systems and computers and spreadsheets and templates and language when we go to the investment committee revolves around expected return, utility function, all this stuff that just bullshit. It is not mathematically robust. It is not accurate. And as we talk all the time, it's a disbenefit to the end capital owner and possibly a benefit to the fiduciary. And so we're out fighting that battle every day, and we're always doing our crazy deep research and physics and chaos theory and all the crazy stuff that we're playing on. The arrow of time is the biggest complication. And then, running our portfolio and always looking, managing what was attractive cheap volatility 2, 3, 4 years ago, interest rate volatility, obviously, and managing the complexity of the structures that we bought way back then and the complexity of how those complex derivative structures get managed within the professional dealer community, and then sourcing fresh, cheap volatility that, thank God, keeps knocking on the door every day. And what that is or may be, shocks us almost every day. Somebody shows up saying, hey, would you be interested in this? And we're like, tell us about it. You've got volatility to sell on some random underlying. Fine, tell me about it. What are you doing? Oh, well, we're doing this, we're doing that, and the clients and blah, blah, blah. And we're like, great, let's do it. Let's start, as we say, start the dance. You tell me what you want to sell. I'll tell you what I want to buy. And then we'll see if we can, find the part of the dance floor where we can dance the closest together and do something that works for both parties. And we're helping them because they're recycling volatility that's coming in from their client activities of structured derivative product stuff. And we're getting stuff that has, we think, attractive asymmetry and convexity that offsets, that provides the breaking for our clients who are then out taking more risk and not sitting in a bunch of stuff that's targeted at the mean, not sitting in fixed income carry strategies and stuff that performs well if expectations happen and perform badly if it doesn't. And most generally speaking, most of the stuff that has evolved through this period of suppressed volatility and stable correlations, these diversifying strategies, stuff that, as in my football analogy, defensive midfielders, guys you put in your portfolio to diversify your growth assets, but it turns out they're poor goal scorers, and you probably evaluate them on goal scoring because that's your only metric, and they're never playing defense when you need them. So they end up being low correlation in good markets and high correlation in bad markets. It's just dead capital, which is why, in all my scattergrams, all of the traditional investment structures start to look like short puts. That's what they are. They're bounded upside, correlated downside. And the premise is clean that out, get something explicit, breaks, explicit goalkeeping, and be more aggressive in your risk-taking and benefit in this sort of convexity in the wings. And that's, where the returns are. That's where the drivers to compounding paths are. And in the crazy world that we're in, there's always something. There's always something that's cheap. And it means, you've heard me say this 1,000 times, turn my brain off. I don't have an opinion. I don't say I'm not buying that because I don't think they'll ever allow that to happen. I don't think that'll ever, you know, if somebody will sell me an option that's priced like it will never happen, I'll buy it.
Yeah. No matter what it is, right? It doesn't matter. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. I hate the potato market. I'll buy calls on it all day if they're cheap enough. I don't care. And that stuff comes along, and the proliferation of complex risk and uncapitalized risk that flows through the regulated financial system because, put most simply, you know, the whole system either doesn't have to account for the risk or measures the risk as two standard deviations on a Gaussian distribution in an underlying market that at best is Pareto and probably is far more power law dynamic than that.
Terrific. Listen, whenever you and I get together, there's always so much to talk about. So I'm really grateful for your time. I know it's Sunday there. We will do this again, and I will make sure that you, me, and Peter have a conversation, because I think that would be absolutely fascinating, and I'd love for the two of you guys to meet. So I will make that happen. I will do all of your publicity for you. So don't worry. I will tell everybody where to go and read all your stuff, because I'm very happy to do that, and I will be more insistent than you. You'll be far too humble and polite about it, and I will badger people to go and read all your stuff. So, Dave, listen, thanks again for the time. I really appreciate it, and we'll do this again, and we'll drag Peter into the fray.
That'd be fun. That'd be fun. I really appreciate it, Grant. I hope your travels don't destroy you.
Yeah, you know what? Listen, I've got to get old one day. I may as well, the quicker I can do it, the better, I guess. The travel is certainly taking care of that.
I guess since these don't come out as videos, I'll say to people, be careful or it'll turn your hair gray.
Yeah, right. That's it. Thanks, mate. I appreciate that. All right, I'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Dave.
Cheers, buddy. Thanks.
See you, mate. Oh boy. Well, there you go. As always, so much to think about. You know, a conversation with Dave Dredge is always just a massive download for your brain. And I always walk away with more questions than I came in with, which is just such a terrific thing to have. Now, you'll find all Dave's writing at the website convex-strategies.com. I would urge you to go and read every single word of Dave's you can find. Read them in chronological order. They lay out a beautiful roadmap of how the market evolves. He's easy to get a hold of. He's very responsive. So feel free to drop him questions. And if you can't get on him for some reason, send the questions to me and I'll make sure he gets them. Again, my thanks to Dave Dredge for another terrific 90 minutes there. I'll be back with another guest in the not too distant future. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye. Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.